Thank you very much. Josh Galloway is today here as guest. Okay. I would like to thank you for the beautiful event held in University of Birmingham. Educated a lot in issues in Palestine. Coming back from another issue, as you're aware of, in Somalia there's a lot of problems regarding the youth feeling a lot of alienation. There's a lot of extremism building up from here, going back to Somalia. There's also a lot of racial issues building up from here, then goes back to Somalia. Are you aware of the Somalia?
Very much so. In fact, again, if you go to YouTube, you'll see my speech in Parliament on Somalia earlier this year, which I think will indicate the attitude that I take. I speak about it on my television and radio shows quite often because we have a lot of viewers and listeners, either from the Somali community here in Britain or indeed in Somalia itself. In short, Somalia has been subject to military subversion from Ethiopia, acting as a surrogate of Western interests. They indeed even invaded and occupied Somalia, with disastrous results for themselves as well as for the country and the people. Mm-hmm. And now we have the mother of all messes in Somalia, where different militia are controlling different parts of even the capital city, Mogadishu. Mm-hmm. This is because of the level of interference in Somalia's internal affairs that have characterized the last 25 years, actually, of Somalia's history. So far as the Somalis here in Britain, a very large number of them are outside of the political process because they're here as refugees. They don't have votes. Therefore, the politicians don't go looking for them and don't try to bring them in. We in the Respect Party, on the other hand, have not only a big Somali support and membership, we installed some of the Somali leadership in our leadership and ran them as candidates, for example, in the Greater London Assembly elections in May. So Somali engagement in British democratic life is very important, and British disengagement from Somali politics is equally important.
Thank you very much. My second question is building the mentality of the youngsters living in Western countries such as the UK. Is it possible, you think, that the government can contribute more positive messages to the youngsters that are living here? As you said, they came from a refugee, they were refugee status, they came over this country, they tried to educate themselves. Is it possible that the British government can actually do more to welcome these youngsters and influence
them? Possible that they could do much more, but it's not probable that they will do any more. On the contrary, the British government's characteristic posture so far as any group of immigrants or asylum seekers is concerned is to wish that they weren't here and to pander to the racists in the media and in Parliament and on the streets with the BNP and the rest to compete with these right-wing anti-immigration forces as to the best way to exclude as many people from the country as possible. So I don't expect that the government will change its tune in the last 6 months of its life, and I don't expect that the government of David Cameron, which is coming along soon, will be any more sympathetic to immigrants and asylum seekers than the government we've got. What immigrants and asylum seekers should do is combine with those of us who stand with them to make a big and mighty political force to fight for the rights of refugee and immigrant communities. That's what Respect stands for. And people can go to Respect through the website and come to me through my website, georgegalloway.com. We'll find things for them to do to make the position better.
If you might, can you invite them for the Viva Palestine?
Yes, we're heading for Gaza on the 6th of December. God willing, we'll arrive in Gaza on the 27th of December. We're going through Europe, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, all the way to Gaza, where the Palestinian people desperately need our help. Go to vivapalestina.org on the internet. See how you can help. Thanks very much indeed. Salaam alaikum.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Salma Yaqub, the leader of the Respect Party, who joined us today for the event at the University of Birmingham. Salma, what do you have got to say to the youngsters, whether they be Muslims or non-Muslims, who are not aware of the issues in Palestine, the issues in Somalia, the issues of Iraq, the issues in Chechnya, wherever the Muslims' occupations are going on and these fightings and killings?
Well, it's so important to first of all become informed about what is going on, because one of the weapons that they do use is to keep people in ignorance, because the truth is so powerful. So I think tonight's event was absolutely fantastic when you see hundreds of students coming here and actually learning about the truth, because when they then spread their lies, they'll be challenged far, far more. I think that's the first very important step. So you cannot underestimate the power of information.
Finally, Salma, what do you've got to say to the Somali, specifically the Somali youngsters, who are in education and who are not in education, that the philosophy for a lack of light, there is always darkness, to actually educate themselves and become aware of the issues back in back their homes and stuff?
Well, first of all, you should be proud of your identity. It's not just about having only one identity. If you have Somali heritage, you should be proud of that, know more about it. And actually, being in England, you are amongst the most powerful people in the world, because what happens here, the policies that are initiated here, impact on people abroad in a way that you can have more influence on what politicians do here, sometimes people in those countries themselves. So first of all, I would say it's an amana, a responsibility, it's a privilege, an honour, it's a fight, it's always a jihad in that sense, but it's a non-violent one that we have here. And remember, the first word that was revealed in the Quran was Iqra, read. So again, the importance of education. And so this is something that we have the opportunity in this country to make the most of it and use it not just for yourself and your own family, but for the betterment of all humanity.
Thank you very much, Salma Yaqub. I've got two of the students here at the university that joined the event. What's your name?
My name is Fawzia.
I'm Huda.
As you guys are aware, there are some similar issues in Somalia, although it's not an occupation as such, or there's not in that level of distrust, but there is a lot of poverty and fight and war and killings back in Somalia. What do you got to say to the Somali youth that live in here that don't contribute to back home, or those that live in back home? What do you got to say to them?
All I gotta say is, you know what, the reason why you're here and the reason why your parents have brought you here is to make a future for yourself and for your people back home. So my advice for you is through efforts to hide things, and without efforts you will never get nowhere, so try harder.
Okay. Was your similar message?
I'm saying to the smiling brothers and sisters that, as Allah said, Allah will not change the condition of a qawm, of people, until they change the condition of themselves, until there's change is in themselves. So we as youth should change and make sure that our country has a future, as well as all the Muslim countries, because we brought ourselves to this stage and we need to stand up and speak up and speak against these terrible crimes that's being committed against humanity.
One final question for you. Do you think that the level of ignorance, the level of education being so low in the Somali society, whether in Western countries or back home, that contributes to a extreme mentality of fighting and killing and massacres and that sort of things?
Yes, it's true, say, because if we knew, whether it's the educational level or whether it's the religious level, Islamically it said that killing one person is like killing the whole of humanity, and saving one person is saving the whole of humanity, and justice is seen as in throughout the Western world. So if we were just, whether it was in the religious term or whether it was in the Western term, then we would realise that with education you'll realise that justice, it means not killing or not doing anything wrong in the eyes of the law or in the eyes of God.
So are you saying the similar, basically the philosophy, where there's no light there is darkness?
Exactly that. You speak the truth even as against yourselves, your parents, your friends. If you see something wrong, stand up, speak up and talk about it, and don't just leave it in darkness.
One more thing, Africa is seen as the dark of heart, the heart of darkness. So make sure that you prove the people, you prove those Western views wrong, that we are actually the light of heartness.
Thank you very much, guys. Thanks. Mayed, can you tell me, what did you think of the event tonight?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, the event was I found very successful. I think George Galloway made his point very clearly and very directly. Some people tried to protest against it in vain, because you know a lot of the arguments against were not great. It's clear what the injustice is. It's clear what's happening, and you know, like anybody with an ounce of humanity would see what it is. And I commend him for coming down here and going across the country and doing what he did.
Did you think that speakers such as George Galloway, who actually speak from their heart and know a lot and participate in a lot of these issues, such as in Palestine, whether it be Iraq, Afghanistan, or Somalia, do you think like would be a prominent figure such as George Galloway to take them to Somalia and put a media coverage on the issues that are actually there?
Definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, if somebody does speak from the heart and they do speak for justice, you see the amount of support that they get. You know, he might have not been supported by the British government, etc., who have their own interests. But at the end of the day, if you speak from the heart and you speak for justice, people will support you. And you can see that for the amount of people that turned out today, especially at this university. And, you know, I think it would be a great deal of help to, you know, other countries if you went to Somalia to give talks like that, you know. Maybe not George Galloway, but you know, people of that, you know, people of that stature, mm-hmm. and you know, that, you know, that can command an audience and knows what he's talking about, I think that'd be a great help.
Finally, what would you say to the Somali youth, whether it be the Western countries or back home in Somalia, in connection to raising awareness the issues that are back home? What would you advise them?
You know, I think people really, really need to. I think it comes down to a parenting system. You know, we look at the youth, but you know, we have to look at the parents. I think a lot of the time, especially in this country, people are very, very, very quick to judge youth, regardless of whether they're Somali or not, on their actions, etc. When you know they come from possibly a very difficult background, and their parents are incapable at times to raise them only in this environment, mm-hmm. not back home, but I'm saying in this environment, because they're caught up in something that they don't know very well. So then the children have to almost, not in terms of the essentials, but in terms of everything else, they have to fend for themselves. They have to learn this country by themselves. You know, we can't be led astray. I think it's important for people to be in the mosque. It's important for people to practice the salahs. And it's important for parents to enforce that in their children, you know, in the best way possible. And, you know, people won't go astray. Mm-hmm. I think that's the best thing. Turn to your deen, and, you know, there's no more than that.
Jazakallah khair, Mu'ayyad, and that was Mu'ayyad.
Okay, assalamu alaikum.
Adam, can you tell us a little bit of the organization that actually organized this event?
Basically, we're a student-led society, a group at the University of Birmingham. But our goal is to raise awareness of the Palestinian issue, to campaign on international law issues.
Regarding the event, what did you think of it? Did it go according to plan?
I think, although appearing to start initially a bit tense and slightly intimidating, mm-hmm. It went fine. And George Galloway, as always, spoke from the heart. I think a lot of people knew what they would be getting when they came here,
yeah.
but they liked to hear it anyway. And I think George Galloway just sort of lifts people's morale, which is a good thing, the good thing about him, which is why we invited him here, actually, in the first place.
Do you think in the future would be a good idea to get such a figure like George Galloway into the convoy to Somalia, basically, and publicize the issues that there?
Yeah, it is.
Are you aware of it?
It is. Well, first of all, I was never aware of any effort to organize a convoy to Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is possible. You just got to get a lot of highly motivated Somalian people, not necessarily born in Somalia, but people who know the culture and language of their homeland,
mm-hmm.
and have a passion to sort things out, because I know there's been a civil war for
many years,
probably before I was, like, probably the root of it is before I was born,
mm.
so I feel for the Somalian people, and they've been invaded by various countries now, and dumping waste on this. I think the best strategy for the Somalian issues is to mention it in a wider context first, so that people are reminded of it, and then produce events like this, but about Somalia.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Mr. Chairman, Councillor Salma Yaqub, hopefully soon the first ever Muslim woman Member of Parliament for Birmingham Sparkbrook, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, and enemies. Assalamu alaikum, peace be on all of you. This, you know, I speak at public meetings almost every day. Last night in Manchester, tomorrow in Glasgow, on Wednesday in East London, and so on. Almost every day. I have two national radio shows broadcasting for 6 hours live across the country every weekend. I have two international television shows broadcasting to people all around the world. And the only place in the whole country where anybody ever tries to stop me speaking is Birmingham University. And I really don't understand that. In one way, it's a compliment. The fact that so many people have come here to hear what I have to say tonight will have been helped by the efforts to stop me speaking here, as the government of Canada found recently when they banned me from entering Canada, even though I was then touring the United States of America and addressing the United Nations at their headquarters in New York. I subsequently spoke by video link to the very same meetings I was going to address in person in Canada, except they were 4 or 5 times bigger than they would otherwise have been. So, a friendly note to those who campaigned to stop me being here this evening. Thanks very much. But let me address, if I may, some of the arguments which those who sought to stop this meeting have adduced, because they are the arguments that are advanced to try to close down discussion on this subject and have been the methods for very many years. The fact that the only place that they have any traction is Birmingham University alone of all the universities and cities in the country shows that the argument is fading, but let's deal with it. The argument is that criticism of Israel, that opposition to Israel, that support for the Palestinians somehow equates to anti-Semitic racism. This canard was dragged out for decades to keep people away from, to inoculate themselves from any understanding of the truth in the Middle East, any understanding of who are the victims and who are the perpetrators of terrorism on the Israel-Palestine question. And it won't wash. First of all, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Jews in the world support the campaign for justice for the Palestinian people. Indeed, some of our strongest supporters are Jews. Thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of Jews deny that Israel speaks for them or represents them in any way. Those are the Jews who take as their role model Albert Einstein, one of the greatest human beings who ever lived, the greatest scientist who ever lived, one of the greatest minds who ever lived, who was a Jew and who was asked to be the first president of Israel. And this is what he said: "I could never be the president of a country whose future happiness is built upon the misery of the people whose land it was. And I could never be the president of a country whose future is built on the denial of the past of the people who lived there." Einstein was a Jew, a great Jew. When I entered the Gaza Strip last July, I was accompanied by 5 Jewish rabbis and another 5 secular Jewish leftists. None of them were self-haters. All of them were glad to be Jews. They just didn't accept that Israel spoke for them. And it follows that someone like me, who has spent their entire life
fighting against racism in all of its forms, could not possibly be associated with the kind of racism that in the 20th century marched 6 million Jews to their death in the gas chambers of Nazi-occupied Europe. A Holocaust which was the greatest crime of the 20th century, the denial of which, in my view, ought to be a crime, and which may have been the greatest crime in all human history. And that's why I say, call me mad, call me sad, even if you like, call me bad. But if you call me anti-Semitic, you better bring your solicitor with you, because you'll face me in the High Court of England for defamation. For I will not accept this foul charge. Still less will I make it a reason to remain silent about the truth which I'm about now to tell you. Some of you know it. Some of you are victims of it. I myself have sat for the last 23 years in the British Parliament, which was the scene of many crimes and was the scene of the original crime, the original sin against the Palestinian people. Because in 1917, on behalf of one people, the British Foreign Minister, Mr. Balfour, on behalf of us, promised to a group of Zionist Jews the land which belonged to the Palestinian people. Somebody who did not possess Palestine at the time in 1917 gave it away to a group of strangers in an act brazen even by imperial standards. And that Balfour Declaration is the original sin in the Palestinian issue. From it, all blood and misery that has flown since originates. And it's one of the reasons why I, as a British parliamentarian, and I'm arguing you, as citizens and residents of Britain, have a special responsibility to try to recover some modicum of justice for the Palestinian people because of our own country's role in the wiping off the map of the country of Palestine, the scattering to the four corners of the earth of millions of Palestinians, now in the third generation living as refugees, lucky ones here in Birmingham, unlucky ones in the rancid, rat-infested hovels of the refugee camps scattered around the Arab Middle East. It's because, although myself I had no familial link to empire, on the contrary, as someone of Irish background, our family were victims of empire. It was the empire what done it. And that means we have a responsibility to try to undo it. I want to focus for a minute on this group of atheist Jews who called themselves Zionists, to whom Palestine was promised by the British Foreign Minister, Mr. Balfour, who didn't do it, by the way, because he liked Jews. As a matter of fact, he hated Jews. He was an anti-Semitic racist who wanted all the Jews to leave England so that he would never have to look at their faces again. An unfortunate mirror image of the Zionist idea, which many shared, including the Hitlerites themselves, as recent scholarship makes clear. Zionism and Nazism were two sides of the same coin. The Zionists argued the German Jews were not German, that they were not people who ought to remain in Germany. And Hitler said, thanks very much. That's what I've been arguing. The only difference was The Zionists wanted the German Jews to go to Palestine. The Nazis wanted to march them into the gas chamber and annihilate them. But that they ought not to be in Germany, that the English Jew is not really English, that the French Jew is not really French, this is something that the Zionists and the anti-Semites had in common. And we shall see where that leads us. Balfour promised a group of atheists the land of Palestine. Why have I three times mentioned atheists? Because the second argument adduced by supporters of Israel after they've deployed the anti-Semite allegation is that somehow God promised them the land of Palestine, as if God were an estate agent parceling out pieces of real estate to bidders. It's important to know that not a single one of the Zionist Jews to whom Palestine was promised believed in the Bible, Old Testament or New. This claim that there is a biblical justification for wiping Palestine off the map and scattering its people and resettling it with more advanced European settlers had any kind of religious or biblical justification is an invention after the fact, and one which has just been dealt a deadly, I believe, fatal blow by a new book written by a professor at Tel Aviv University, who will be here this week in England, called The Invention of the Jewish People. A piece of scholarship which will change everything, which devastates the lie. Even if anyone in their right mind could agree that people have the right to go back to where they were 2,000 years ago and kick off the people who've been there in the intervening 2,000 years and form a state there because they were there 2,000 years ago, even if there was anyone crazy enough to believe that, given the total chaos that the world would be plunged into when the Vikings arrived from Norway and told the rest of you in Birmingham to clear off because they were here 2,000 years ago. Although the Romans might have something to say about that, assuming any Roman would be crazy enough to want to leave Italy and come and live here. And the Angles and the Saxons and the Picts and the Celts would be taking to their longboats and sailing the seven seas and saying, my family was here 2,000 years ago. I'm here to assert my right to return. Even if there was anyone crazy enough to believe that that's a way we could order the world, this new book, The Invention of the Jewish People, ends the argument, because the vast majority of the Jews in Israel are descendants of people who were never in Palestine in the first place. There was no exodus. There was no exodus. There was no parting of the seas. There was no exile. And therefore, the demand for a right of return is completely negated. You cannot have a right to return to somewhere you never were in the first place, even 2,000 years before. So the two prime arguments of the Zionists that their opponents are anti-Semites and that God in the Bible gave them the title to this land of Palestine are, I believe, fast fading assets which may only be cashable any longer here in the University of Birmingham, and not, I predict, for very much longer. Let's look at the reality. The reality is that these people to whom Balfour promised the land of Palestine had no particular wish to go to Palestine. They merely wanted to form a European settler state anywhere. anywhere at all. They discussed with the British Empire several places that they might found their European settler state. This is fact. The Friends of Israel might not like it, but it is a fact that they discussed forming their state of Israel in Uganda. It is a fact that they negotiated for the Seychelles in which to found their Zionist state. It is a fact that they discussed seriously forming their state, their European settler state, as far away as Patagonia in Latin America. They went to Palestine because Balfour said that having a loyal little Ulster formed by European settlers in the middle of the Arab and Muslim world could be quite a useful thing for the British Empire, so vast at that stage that upon it the sun never set. Though, as my Irish grandfather always said, that's because God would never trust the British in the dark. That's why the British supported the Zionist claim to the land, so that it could be an implantation in the Middle East, as the six counties of the north east of Ireland were an implantation of the British Empire in Ireland, so that another little loyal Ulster could help the British Empire keep the natives divided and ruled the better to steal their things. It's no more glamorous than that. It's just another European settler state, just like the European settler state of South Africa, just like the European settler state of Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, of Kenya and other places, where people, because they could, because of the superiority of their economic, scientific and political development, and the superiority of their weapons, and above all the superiority of their allies, could take other people's countries and ruthlessly exploit them for their own benefits. There's no mystery about the Zionist settler state of Israel. There's nothing biblical about it. It's just another, now slightly shabby, European settler state, just like all the others. And who were the victims of this lie? This lie that the Jews were a people without a land, even though the vast majority of Jews at the time of the Balfour Declaration were not supporters of Zionism. In fact, the very opposite. They were the avant-garde of the communist and socialist and liberal and leftist movements in the world. They were the avant-garde, actually, of European society, with titanic thinkers like Marx and others at the very top of the tree of European intellectual, cultural civilization. But at the time that this promise was made, the Zionists said it was for a people without a land, even though they all had lands in which they had all lived for thousands of years, subject, yes, to periodic anti-Semitic racism, yes, but not at the hands of Arabs, not at the hands of Muslims, at the hands of European Christians. And they said that for this people without a land, Palestine could be a land without people. The only problem was it was full of people. An inconvenient truth that would have to be extirpated by terror, and by terror it partly was. When you hear, the next time you hear a supporter of Israel talking about terrorism, tell them they can't fool you. That you know that the prime ministers of Israel, without exception, except until modern times when age ruled it out. We're all members of one or other of the terrorist organizations that blew up the King David Hotel, killing 94 people, most of them British civil servants, who hanged British soldiers in the orange groves near Jaffa with barbed wire around their necks, who carried out assassinations and bombings, assassinations even of the United Nations chief envoy to the region, who at the moment is Tony Blair. Not since Caligula appointed his horse as a proconsul of Rome has there been a more inappropriate appointment than Tony Blair as the United Nations peace envoy. But the previous peace envoy was shot through the face and killed by Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir personally, with his own hand and with his own gun. So don't listen to this guff about terrorism. The Zionist movement triumphed because of terrorism. It waded to independence up to its knees in the blood of British, European, and Palestinian, above all, blood on its way to independence. And it then drove, eliminating hundreds of Palestinian villages, destroying them totally, killing, murdering, massacring the inhabitants of those villages, but always carefully leaving a few alive so that they could run and tell the others what had just happened, creating the stampede, which led to 800,000 Palestinians running away from their country, locking their doors but keeping the key because they intended to return one day to their homes, about which more later, and heading for the exile of which I spoke earlier, from which they have never been allowed to return.
Excuse me. Everybody here has come to listen to Mr. Galloway. We'll have a Q&A session afterwards, and we'll grant you the honor of the first question. If you could remain seated and quiet and respectful of the rest of the evening. Thank you.
Massacres like Deir Yassin. Remember it. Deir Yassin. D-E-I-R, second word, Y-A-S-I-N. One of the most wicked and evil acts of ethnic cleansing, of mass murder of women and children, of pregnant women bayoneted to kill both the unborn and the mother, in their hundreds, carried out by Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, the leader of the other Israeli terror gang. So the next time you hear a supporter of Israel talking to you about terrorism, ask them to tell you about Begin and his murder gang, or Shamir and his murder gang. Ask them to tell you about the massacres of places like Deir Yassin. And if they say to you that's too long ago, let's come up to date. Let's come up to date with an Israeli Prime Minister who's still alive, albeit in a vegetative state. Let's come up to the period of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. You remember him? George Bush described him as a man of peace. Even Sharon didn't regard himself as a man of peace. Even Sharon scratched his head at that one. Let me tell you about Sharon, because I was there when Israel, not for the first, and certainly not for the last time, invaded Lebanon like a huge military juggernaut, sweeping over the border, crushing all before them, destroying the western half of an Arab capital, Beirut, with phosphorus bombs, which the children inhaled and then breathed out as their lungs cooked inside them until they were dead. I was there. I saw it. I saw the children cooking to death in front of me. When they had finally driven the Palestinian resistance from the city and into further exile in Tunisia, no sooner had the American plenipotentiary Philip Habib signed a piece of paper guaranteeing the safety of the families of the Palestinian fighters who had just departed, no sooner were their ships out of the bay when Ariel Sharon encircled the Palestinian camps of Sabra and Shatila. He brought to the perimeter gigantic searchlights, bigger than any lights you've ever seen. I was there, I saw them. Which, when switched on in the evening time, turned night into day. They surrounded the camps with Israeli forces and tanks and unleashed their allies, the Lebanese phalangist fascist militia, to enter the camps where they murdered 3,784 women and children and old men, who were all that remained in the camps, as the fighters had all departed under international guarantee. Don't deny it, you friends of Israel, because the biggest demonstration against it took place in Tel Aviv. Sharon himself was cashiered from the Israeli government as defense minister for his indirect responsibility for this massacre. That didn't stop him coming back as prime minister and committing new and terrible crimes in many other places. But that happened. So the next time you hear a supporter of Israel talking about terrorism, ask them what happened in Sabra and Shatila to 3,784 Palestinian refugees, women, children, and old men. You see, the point I'm trying to make is this, that it's not the Palestinians who are the terrorists. It's the Palestinians who are the victims of terrorism. It's not Israel who's the victims of terrorism. It's Israel who's the perpetrator of terrorism against a people whose land they've stolen, but who won't go away, you see. That's the problem. If the Palestinians had decided, like the Cherokee or the Comanche, that they were defeated finally and utterly, find us a reservation somewhere and put us there and forget about us, then there would be no problem. The Israeli European settlers would be enjoying the gardens of Palestine today. But it's because the Palestinians refuse to go into the museum to be looked at like the Cherokee. It's because they say we exist and we insist on returning to our country which you stole, that makes this problem so intractable. Let me tell you about another of Sharon's massacres. And again, I know this because I was there. In the town of Jenin, on the West Bank. There's a refugee camp, which may be the worst refugee camp in the world. It's certainly the worst Palestinian refugee camp. It's 1 kilometer square, and in it 17,000 families live in 1 square kilometer. It's a terrible place, but the most terrible thing of all is that from the rooftops of the camp, the refugees can see the city from which they were driven. The shining city of Haifa, the beautiful city of Haifa on the sea. The people who live in the Jenin refugee camp can see their own houses being lived in by foreigners from England, from New York, from Paris, from Russia, whilst they, for 60 years, have lived in the misery of this refugee camp. And out of this camp in Jenin have come more suicide bombers than any other place in Palestine. And why do you think that might be? Why might somebody living in a rat-infested refugee camp who can see their own garden being played in by foreigners from New York, whilst they must remain in this refugee camp looking at their own property, taken by force by others, why might they, do you think, feel so angry that they would be ready to blow themselves up and take as many others with them in their rage at their despair? So the next time you hear a supporter of Israel talking to you about the suicide bombers and the terrorism that emanates from this fractured and subjugated Palestinian population, ask them about the refugee camp in Jenin. Now, I want to leave time for questions and answers. So let me come to a conclusion about what I think needs to be done, which may obviate some of the questions. I should tell you right up front that I became involved in this issue in 1975 when I was 21 years old, and I have been in it ever since. And I entered it as a supporter of President Arafat, and I remain a supporter of the memory and the political line of President Arafat. I'm not a supporter of Hamas. I have never been a supporter of Hamas. But I am a supporter of democracy, and the only people with the right to choose the Palestinian leaders are the Palestinian people themselves, not America or Britain, still less Israel or its friends here in the University of Birmingham. And because I was a supporter of Arafat, I supported the Oslo Agreement and the division of Israel-Palestine on a grotesquely unfair basis, with Israel keeping 78% of the land and the Palestinians being given 22% of the land, separated into two parts by Israel. That's what the Oslo Agreement promised the Palestinians living under occupation, illegal military occupation, for the last 42 years. But it offered the Palestinians in the refugee camps outside absolutely nothing at all, with no right of return to the homes from which they were driven. But still I supported it, grotesque though it was in its division of the land, unjust as it was in its desertion of the refugees. I believed that it was the best that the Palestinians could achieve, given the collapse of their allies in the former Soviet Union and the former socialist bloc, and the collapse of the Arab world into the miserable parody of an Arab world which it is today. I supported it, and it has completely failed. 1994 to 2009, not only has not an inch of Palestine been liberated in all that time, as promised under the Oslo Agreement, but every step that could conceivably be taken to make the separation of the peoples into these two states impossible has already been undertaken. Israeli settlements, which, in case you don't know, are not some romantic log cabin collection up on top of a mountain, they are cities being built on illegally occupied land, have proceeded to the extent that no separation is now any longer possible. The apartheid wall, condemned by the United Nations and condemned by the World Court as a crime, has gotten longer and bigger and more permanent. East Jerusalem has been ethnically cleansed as a matter of deliberate policy, with the demolition of Palestinian houses, the eviction of Palestinian families, the systematic seizure and confiscation of Jerusalem resident permits for those Palestinians who still had them, making the Palestinian claim to East Jerusalem all the more difficult to sustain. I believe now that the possibility of a two-state solution to this conflict is gone, and that we should now argue for, fight for, and support what was the only democratic and legitimate solution in the first place, which is this: that there should be one state called Israel-Palestine, or Palestine-Israel. Take your pick. One state from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, where all the people entitled to live there, whether Jewish, Muslim, or Christian, live as equal citizens under the law, electing one government, one man, one woman, one vote. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? That's the type of government we demand everywhere else, isn't it? When Mandela was freed from Paulsmoor prison, the leaders of the European settler apartheid state asked Mandela, can't we have the Orange Free State as a white country, as a white state? You can have all the rest. And Mandela answered, we don't believe in white states or black states. We believe in democratic states where every man and woman is the equal of the other under the law, and where every man and woman elects or unelects the government of the day. What's wrong with that? If it's good enough as a solution to apartheid South Africa, why isn't it good enough as a solution to the conflict in Israel, Palestine? I'd like to hear any supporter of Israel argue that it's not, because to do so, they would have to fall back on the argument that Jews have a right to the superiority of themselves within the state, which is what they have now, somewhat to their embarrassment. Here at the University of Birmingham, they now have a government committed to forcing all non-Jews, and there's nearly 2 million of those, to sign an oath that they accept that Israel is a Jewish state. Imagine, if you will, in the United States of America, all the black people being asked to sign an oath that America was a white state. Even the Ku Klux Klan wouldn't have the nerve to advance that as a policy, but that is the policy of the current government of the state of Israel. So if you're of a mind, and one person at least in the room is, to argue that Jews are superior to other people, have the right to be in a state where their superiority is enshrined in law, where only they can buy property, only they can live here and there, only they can do these jobs, and the others are second or third class citizens, unless you are one of those ready to defend such apartheid, then you better think more carefully about the solution I am proposing. Now finally, there is a great movement for boycotting Israel, for divesting from Israel, and from taking sanctions against Israel of the kind that we took against apartheid South Africa, because the closest example of Israel today is the apartheid South Africa era. And the campaign against them must mirror that reality. But to these three great campaigning initiatives, I add another. As was said in the introduction earlier, I and my friends in respect formed Viva Palestina, which left England on the 14th of February with a huge convoy of aid bound for Gaza in the aftermath of the murderous bombardment which the small territory had suffered. Don't take my word for that. Take the word of Richard Goldstone, the South African Jewish judge whose daughter is a citizen of Israel, who describes her father as loving Israel. Take his word, Richard Goldstone's report to the United Nations, which describes the war crimes and the crimes against humanity. Imagine a country calling itself the Jewish state, dropping gas on refugees locked up with nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. Not my allegation, Goldstone's allegation. The breaking of the siege of Gaza, which we did from England in February, March, did from the United States in July, we will do again, God willing, from England on the 6th of December of this year, just 4 weeks from now. We'll be leaving East London, driving through Europe, through Turkey, through Syria, Jordan, sailing to Egypt, and breaking the siege through the gates at Rafah, arriving, God willing, on the 27th of December, the anniversary of the war last year. If you want to come on our convoy, if you want to support our convoy in any way, go quickly to our website, vivapalestina.org, vivapalestina.org, and at the very least, pray for us or wish us well. Thank you very much.